Thank you. As I was saying, in theoretical physics, getting wired usually referred to the amount of coffee that people drink, but I see the ITP is giving a new meaning to it today. So my brief then is to explain to you why the formation of galaxies is an interesting problem in physics at the present time, at the level of a theoretical colloquium, but I think a theoretical colloquium that the condensed matter theorists, turbulence theorists, and others at the ITP will feel comfortable with. And so I've elected to give a fairly general overview of the topic, which I hope we'll see if you think it's appropriate. So the first question to ask is, why is the present time an interesting time to be studying how galaxies formed? And the answer, as always, or almost always, comes from the experimental data, from the observational data that we have on galaxy formation. And I think we can distinguish a variety of different reasons why this particular field has become active over the last 5 to 10 years. And it's, I think, currently in a very active state. Is this here for some reason, Kevin, or can I get a bit more? Well, that's certainly, to the level I'm talking about in the talk, this is actually a good representation of a galaxy. So I'm sorry about that, John. Oh, well, actually, I need one other plot. Okay, now that's basically a complete representation of a galaxy in two projections. Maybe you also need to know an arrow to know this thing actually rotates. So let me begin by summarizing what I see as the principal observational reasons why galaxy formation has become very active. And the first one is that finally, over the last 5 or 6 years, we've actually seen a substantial population of high redshift galaxies. And these are not galaxies that are associated with strong nuclear emission like radio sources or quasars, but apparently bright but relatively normal galaxies at high redshifts. In the current situation, there are roughly 1,000 galaxies measured with known redshifts, so that means with spectra, with photometry, so we have images of them. Roughly 1,000 galaxies at redshifts, say between 0.25, less than redshift, less than 3.5. Remember, the definition of the redshift is if you take the expansion of the universe in units of the present size, that's 1/1 plus the redshift. So if you see a galaxy at redshift 3, that means you're seeing it at a time when the universe was 1/4 its present size. So 1,000 is a large number in astronomy. You can do a lot of statistics with 1,000 galaxies. But there are also galaxies known in other redshift ranges. There are now roughly 100 galaxies known at redshifts around 4. So when the universe is approximately 1/5 its present size. And in fact, the most distant objects, individual objects now known, are individual galaxies rather than quasars. For a long period, from the mid-60s until just a few years ago, the most distant objects known were always quasars. That's no longer the case. The most distant individual objects known are now star-forming galaxies. And there are roughly 5 galaxies known. I didn't check the exact number, but it's of order 5. Redshifts greater than 5, with confirmed redshifts. In addition, we heard last week of a sample of galaxies, a large sample of galaxies, about 600, I think it was, galaxies detected with the Keck telescope at redshifts of 1, plus or minus 0.1, essentially all within a redshift of between redshifts of 0.9 and 1.1 or 1.2. There's another sample from the Caltech group, Stidel, Adelberger, and collaborators. So this is a large sample of galaxies when the universe was roughly 1/2 its present size.
Is gravitational
lensing the galaxies? No, the main problem actually with finding the distant first of all, you do need a large enough telescope to be able to collect the light. So getting the spectroscopy for this to confirm the redshifts was critically dependent on having an 8-meter telescope, or 10-meter telescope, the Keck telescopes. The other problem is to identify amongst the many faint galaxies those which are actually very distant. And so these two samples were made possible by detecting techniques which could sort of pull the needle out of the haystack, could identify those faint galaxies which are actually relatively bright things at large distance as compared to nearby objects of low luminosity. So at the limits where these are being detected, which are about the limits at which it's possible to get spectra on the Keck telescope of suitable quality for redshifts, roughly 1 in 100 galaxies on the sky is actually in the high redshift range. And so you need to weed that out of the other 99. And what's used is the broadband spectral characteristics of the galaxies. And so you can pick up special features in the shape of the spectral energy distributions which allow you to identify them. And that's how this was done. Effectively, you just take images of the sky through different filters and then look for patterns which are characteristic of certain redshift ranges. So what you get from this, from the images, also another important aspect of this is now large numbers of these objects also have very good imaging from the Hubble Space Telescope. So you get sizes, luminosities. These are all the techniques that are being used for finding these mean that all the objects that are found are star-forming systems. So you get estimates, rough estimates of star formation rates, how rapidly the galaxies are making new stars. What else is important here? You can get some estimate of their characteristic internal velocities by looking at the widths of the lines in the spectra, which somehow you would like to try and find a way to link to the mass of the objects, which is actually difficult in practice, but you can make some attempts. And you also get measures for these larger samples. You can start to see how they're distributed in space. You can actually measure the spatial clustering of the galaxies at a time when the universe is much smaller than it is today, and measure and compare that with the spatial clustering of the galaxies today. So now, at redshifts 1 and 3, we're actually starting to get relatively good statistics for all these properties for a certain class of galaxies, the class of galaxies you can pick up with these techniques, which I say is essentially things with relatively high star formation rates, and relatively high star formation rates where some fraction of the light actually gets out in the bands that we can observe, which are the rest frame ultraviolet bands. So that's the first point.
High star formation rate.
No, it just means the star formation rate at the time you're looking at it is quite high. You don't know much about the rest of the stellar population. There might be older stars there. There might not. You need additional observational information to tell that. Stars form all the time, effectively, in galaxies. So sometimes some periods in the galaxy's history, they form more rapidly than others. We believe that most galaxies today have lower star formation rates than they did in the past, but the exact distribution of the star formation rate over time is one of the things that we want to understand. Now you understand, don't need to know what galaxies look like. Let me move on to the next observational point, which I think is important. So here we see the light for these galaxies that's coming out in the bands that the optical telescopes are sensitive to, which, because of the redshift effect, means light that was emitted in the rest frame ultraviolet. And we don't know a priori how much of the light of a galaxy comes out in that particular wave band. So to understand the total energetics of where the light from stars go, we have to have measurements of the light produced by galaxies over all wave bands. This is the equivalent of the Olber's paradox. You know, the only reason the night sky is dark is because stars have only been emitting for a finite amount of time, effectively. So they only had 10 to the 10 years to produce light from nucleosynthesis. That light spread over the night sky, redshifted somewhat by the expansion of the universe, but that's not enough to make it bright. The sky is dark. But we don't know, of course, even though it's dark, if we can measure the light on the night sky, that tells us something about how and when the stars formed. But we don't actually know at which wavelength we should look. And so to be sure that we've seen all the light from galaxies, we have to look at all wavelengths. And what's happened recently is that backgrounds have been measured in the far infrared. Far. And the reason that far infrared is a particularly important spectral range in which to look for the light from galaxies is that we understand very well individual stars at what wavelength the light comes out. For example, most of the light from the sun comes out at visual wavelengths. Most of the light from massive stars comes out at ultraviolet wavelengths. But we don't know if the light can come to us undisturbed or whether it can be absorbed and re-emitted by something along the way. And the main problem is that we, in fact, in galaxies, there's a large amount of material, particulate material, between the stars, and this material can absorb the starlight, then heat it up, and the energy is re-emitted at the temperature, essentially thermal emission of the temperature of those grains of dust. And the temperatures are typically around 50 Kelvin, so they're emitted. That radiation is then re-emitted in the far infrared. And we can see this process occurring in star-forming regions in our own galaxy around us. We have evidence that it occurs in galaxies nearby and at all redshifts. What we don't understand is exactly what fraction of the light is absorbed in the, by the dust grains and then re-emitted. So the only way to do a total accounting is to actually observe directly the re-emitted radiation. And to do that, we have to observe in the far infrared. So if you draw a plot with the brightness of the sky, I'm going to call that F nu, it's not the usual notation, times nu. So that's the surface brightness of the sky per unit frequency times the frequency. So that's, if you like, the surface brightness of the sky per decade in frequency as a function of frequency. Put 1 millimeter here. The dominant background is just the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's Planckian with a peak near 1 millimeter, and the bean tail drops off very rapidly shortward of 1 millimeter. Then you have 100 microns, 10 microns, 1 micron. So the visible light then is in this range. So we can actually see the galaxies directly in HST images, integrate all the galaxies we see. We seem to get a convergent result, in fact, if we count galaxies to the faintest limits. That gives us values over here where we can count galaxies down to about 2 microns, if this is possible. And recently in COBE data, there's been a detection of a background over here. Relatively large error bars, but now seems well confirmed at a few hundred microns. And there are limits, some claim, detections from COBE data in between. And it's thought that what's seen here, and there are also counts of galaxies at, it's actually 850 microns, it's right where this is overlapping here. There are actually a few faint sources, presumably distant galaxies, detected 850 microns, allows us to integrate individual counts of objects to a flux, to a limit here, which is actually only about a factor of 2 or so above the apparent diffuse background. So it seems here the diffuse background has apparently been resolved into sources also, very nearly all of it. Now the interesting thing is the level here, the amount of energy in this infrared background, as opposed to what we see directly, and in fact it turns out they're comparable. With most estimates, it seems that there's maybe about twice as much energy in the far infrared as there is in this optical range. And with the limits here, it's possible then we've actually detected, if you draw a smooth line between here, which is not obvious in fact, but anyway, let's just take a smooth line through here. If you take a smooth line through here, then you could say this smooth line would represent all the emission from stars over the whole history of the universe. And we've This is the range where you'd expect most of the emission from dust from high redshift galaxies to appear. So far IR backgrounds detected. And maybe 2/3 of all starlight far infrared. No, that's correct. I mean, there are other possible sources here because all that we know is that something is heating the dust, which is, we don't really even know that until we've resolved it. But the presumption is what we're seeing here is emission from dust grains, probably at high redshift, so those dust grains have to be heated by something. There's actually another possible source of heating, and that is nuclear activity in galaxies, for example, the kind of things that you see in quasars. And the total amount of energy that could be produced by embedded quasars is, it's within an order of magnitude or so of this, so it's unclear what fraction of this light really comes from stars and what some fraction that could be from AGN. So if you're conservative, you might take this as an upper limit on the re-radiated information, light from stars. Okay, next thing I want to talk about. So the reason this is important is that we now think we may have seen all the light from stars over the history of the universe, and so we can do energy budgets for emission. Correct. Yeah, that's. Yeah, they're also detected counts at 150 microns, but I didn't want to go into these details, or I'll never get through.
Really making your point that two-thirds is in the far IR, the near IR, that's around 10 microns, is definitely lower. So your continuous line process really should
drop. I think you're probably right, but this is still contentious, which is why I didn't really want to go into it.
Yeah.
At three microns, the emission is still primarily stellar, and you expect the only stars which really emit strongly at 3 microns are extremely red things like late asymptotic giants, very metal-rich stars, Cardan stars, and so on. So the purely stellar emission, one would expect it to go down here, and the dust emission only starts coming in around 5 microns or a longer wavelength. So this is predicted by detailed modeling, but it doesn't change what I'm saying. Sorry? Yeah, I know, but it's not, but the different groups don't agree on it. So what I want to move on to next, which I think is another important thing which has happened, is that fluctuations have been seen in the cosmic microwave background fluctuations, in the cosmic microwave background. And now there are plausible detections down to quite small angular scales. The reason this is important is we think what we see in the microwave background is structure in the universe at the epoch of recombination. So this is structure at redshift around 1,000 for a time for around 3 × 10⁵ years, 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And the scales are such that 1 arc minute corresponds roughly to 1 megaparsec today. This is roughly the region from which a relatively bright galaxy would form. And this structure now seen in interferometer measurements down to a few arc minutes. And so we're starting to see structure at high redshift, which is plausibly the initial conditions for the formation of objects the size of galaxies, or somewhat larger. So you can say the ICs, the galaxy formation, are becoming observable. So obviously then, what we want to do is make a connection between what we see at high redshift and what we see today. Fourth point, which is also somewhat contentious, but I think is still a strong one on the observational points, is that of course at high redshift, the universe was almost uniform. Everything was smooth. There were no galaxies. Today, we see the galaxies around us. If you go back in time, at some point, the galaxies we see today have to go away. So an important question is, can we see far back enough back in time to actually detect the present-day galaxies no longer there? So if we can, then the assembly of the galaxies must happen between the time when they're not there and when we see them today. Clearly, not a very profound statement. So I think we can now start to argue that the absence of bright galaxies, well, let me call it massive, I think it'll be more accurate, massive galaxies at high redshift, is actually being detected. I think there's now mounting evidence we have seen beyond the point when the present-day bright galaxies were actually assembled. So let me show you a couple of plots how you would do this. So let's imagine we take a present-day galaxy, say an elliptical galaxy, plot redshift here, and flux from the object here. So let's call this 1, 2, 3. Galaxies, this is flux, log flux. You have the object here today. As you go back in time, earlier in time, the stars we see today are mostly old. They were younger. The younger stellar population is brighter. So intrinsically, the object is brighter, but it's a bit further away, so that you get a 1 over r squared dimming from the distance. So if all that had happened is you go back in time, the stars were younger, but they're all still sitting there in the same galaxy, you can predict just from the theory of stellar evolution how bright you'd expect it to be as you went back in time. And its flux would go down, mostly because of the increased distance, but not as much as you might think, because the fact the stars are younger compensates for it slightly. And what you find is if you take a typical bright elliptical galaxy today and you do this exercise, in current day surveys, it's easily detectable back to redshifts of 3. Okay. So if the elliptical galaxies we see today were still there at a redshift of 3, and all that happened was their stars were younger, they'd all be formed at an even higher redshift, then we should see them back to redshift 3. So then the simple question is, let's do a census of the universe at some high redshift and ask if they're there. And it seems there's some indication that they're not. Let me show you an example from the... This actually would have been a case where it would have been simpler to show the data, but I'll draw it for you anyway to make the point. So data from the Hubble Deep Field, which is the northern and southern Hubble Deep Fields, assembled by Mark Dickinson. If instead of redshift along this axis, we plot the volume enclosed out to that redshift, okay, so we know what our cosmology is, we know what the volume of the universe is per steradian out to some distance. Let's plot that as the axis here. And go out to, say, redshift 2. So that half the way to redshift 2 in volume for the standard cosmology today is at redshift 1.4. So half the volume, if you take any area of the sky, half the volume out to redshift 2 is nearer than 1.4, half the volume is out to 1.4. If you take the Hubble Deep Field, with all the work people have done, and take a limit to how far you could go, obviously I have to tell you what I'm plotting vertically here. This is the emitted luminosity of a galaxy at the visual wave band in its rest frame. So I'm plotting. So it's the intrinsic brightness of the galaxy at visual wavelengths at its rest frame. If you know the redshift of a galaxy, then you can infer that from its observed properties, provided you have enough wavelength coverage. And for all the galaxies in the Hubble Deep Field, that is the case. There's enough photometry of enough wave bands, you can do that. So you can, here's the limit to which you could reach, you could get in the Hubble Deep Field. This is nearly flat, but not quite. Let's say a bright elliptical today follows a line where in the past it would be slightly brighter. In V, you get a curve which looks like this. This is the present day. Typical elliptical. So on the Hubble Deep Field, the completeness limit here, you can easily find all points above here because they're much brighter than your completeness limit. So we take the half point in the volume, take all things whose colors allow you to infer a redshift. That's the tricky point here. Sorry? This is 2. This is supposed to be 2. This is 1.41 is here. No. So half the volume is here and half the volume is here. So if all the objects were present across the whole redshift range, you should find of things with the right colors, half of them will be here and half of them will be here. The actual numbers are 26 and 2. So, and clearly something is, whatever's happening, the simple idea that all the stars in elliptical galaxies formed well beyond redshift 2, and that over this whole period all that happened was the stars got older, that's not consistent with the data. Something more complicated had to be happening. Possibly, they were actually assembled over this period. And there are other data which lead in this direction, but I think, to save time, I don't want to go into it now. Correct. So if the galaxies were in several pieces, then you'd have a different answer. This is... No, well, actually, if you look at his plot, he has all the galaxy types, but the conclusion is cleanest for the early types, so that's why I'm giving it here.
Is the idea that they were assembled from stars?
Well, from this data, you don't know. You would have to ask. Well, they appear to be made today of old stars. So if you take that at face value, then the stars were present at these epochs. So if you can't see the galaxies, then they must have been in several different pieces, and the pieces were brought together at later times.
I heard some place that there is evidence that galaxies merged once in their lifetime.
No, I'll come to that. That is that in the standard paradigm explanation of this, but there's a large part of the community which doesn't really accept this yet, and so we need the direct observational proof that the galaxies have gone away, and this is the way to try and get it. Actually, I think it's the shape of the spectral energy distribution, right? Because here's the photometry across certain bands. And so when you fit the spectral energy distributions, you get both a redshift and a sort of basically a mean age of the stellar population. Well, that's this is the minimum brightness to be in the sample. This all I've shown you here is a typical evolution line. My 26 and 2 here, I counted above, I think, what he put for either an L-star or a half L-star, I don't remember. But.
So you're demanding that they
Yeah.
So in other words, the same star is in small pieces of time.
That's correct. That wouldn't matter, actually, because there are actually no objects in this range. Even ones with some star formation. So having some star formation would make them brighter. The only way to get them out of this range by doing this is you not only have star formation, but also have enough gas there with a lot of dust to make them substantially fainter, even at the rest frame V band, then they could drop out below this because of the extinction. So that's the way to get out of it in a moment. No, 0 to 2. Well, there's a surface brightness criterion in order to be picked up in the sample in the first place, yes. So these are only things, obviously, that you could detect in the HDF and do photometry on.
And that is a
But we're, I think, again, I don't have the plot, but I think this is 2 magnitudes above its completeness level, so we're not close to what he thinks is his completeness limit. This line, and actually, here there are only 3, I think, there were only 3 objects in total here. There were more in this range, including bluer things. All right, let me move on, though, otherwise I won't get to the theoretical part of this talk. There's one final piece of observational information which we have, which is also extremely important in this whole thing, and that is, at high redshift, we now can detect apparently most of the raw material for making stars. And that is the intergalactic medium. So let me call the intergalactic medium IGM. So now, well, let me just call this. There are many studies of the intergalactic medium at high redshift. These are done by absorption line studies. So if you look towards a distant quasar, which is beyond, say, redshift 3, then you see absorption due to all the material between us and the quasar, all the diffuse material. And you can use that then to study the state of the material between us and the quasar. And this is it's called quasar absorption line studies. This is another area where there's been tremendous progress since the high-resolution spectrographs were put on the Keck telescope, because they gave the sensitivity to get much better spectra than had previously been possible. And the outcome of this, just summarizing it, the current interpretations, is that apparently most of the baryons at, say, let's call it redshift 3, for example, have been seen. By most, I mean the amount you see is about equal to the amount you think came out of the Big Bang through nucleosynthesis arguments. There are some technical issues associated with this, which the astronomers know, but I don't want to go into now. No, this is diffuse. This is not. This is diffuse gas. Most of them are diffuse hydrogen and helium. And what we also know is that they're most of them are highly ionized. Well, this is the tricky part. Because they're highly ionized, the ones that are actually doing the absorption is only the small fraction which is neutral. So there's a large ionization correction going into the statement. So you have to actually be sure that your ionization correction is right, which is where the technical issues come in. It's highly ionized and it's diffuse.
You can't see most of it.
No, I think I don't. I mean, you do think we don't see the sun only because we see its surface? I mean, you have to have a physical model, obviously. We think we understand the properties of diffuse ionized gases, and that's what's being used to do this. So there are technical issues. So yeah, exactly. So this is a physicist's detected. Even that, I think, you know, you could quibble with. So. But that's semantics. So I mean, let's not. As long as our understanding of the state of the gas, which is we think it's diffuse and highly ionized by the UV background from quasars and possibly young stars, then this is reasonably secure. And there are specialists in the audience who will answer the question better than me if anyone wants to go any further. What we see is there's some, which is quite interesting, there's some chemical enrichment. So although most of this gas is quite diffuse, nevertheless, we detect elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, particularly carbon and sometimes silicon and other elements mixed in with it. Those are presumably produced in stars. So then an interesting issue arises of how, if this stuff is still diffuse and highly ionized, how the heavy elements from the stars were mixed into it. Now let me not get into that. There's an interesting issue there. Though. And we also see some is condensed. And what's interesting is if you take the part which is condensed, you know it's condensed because you see a very strong absorption line. And the very strong absorption line only occurs when you have sufficient column density of hydrogen at the center of the hydrogen absorption cloud is self-shielded from the UV radiation. And so that produces a hydrogen line profile. So if this is the continuum of our spectrum, you see something which is completely black at line center and has characteristic damping wings for a highly optically thick hydrogen cloud. So those are known as damp Lyman alpha systems. Something which is quite interesting about them is the total density. Let me call that omega, the ratio and the total average density per unit volume in units of the critical density closed in the universe. In these damp Lyman alpha systems, say at redshift 2.5, is roughly equal to the total density today in stars and galaxies. So in principle, we've seen enough, approximately, I mean there are factors of 2 uncertainty in this kind of argument, we've seen enough cold condensed gas at redshifts 2.5 to make all the stars, maybe only half, we see locally. That's an important point, which I might get to at the end if I get to the end. No, because the problem is you can see these are in absorption at high redshift. It becomes very hard to see them in absorption at low redshifts. So we have much better information at redshift 2.5 than we do at redshift 0. Okay, well that's almost 40 minutes just on the observational background, but that is anyway the most important part. So now, let me get to the theory. So another aspect of studies in this area is that over the last roughly 2 decades, a more or less standard theoretical model for the evolution of structure has evolved. And so we have a kind of standard model to use as a foil to test against the data. So let me run through what the elements of this standard model are. And all of them, of course, I mean, they're just hypotheses, so all of them can be disputed. So what are the elements of the standard paradigm? Well, the first is that the universe's evolution can be considered as a hot Big Bang, which means it's roughly homogeneous and isotropic since, well, at least roughly 1 second, maybe much earlier, depending how conservative you want to be. So at early times, the universe was very hot, and fluctuations about the uniformity were relatively small. Second major point is the dominant mass component, or dominant energy density, well, in non-relativistic matter, It seems to be cold dark matter, some non-baryonic dark, let me just call it non-baryonic dark matter. With a density in critical units, maybe 0.3, although I don't think one is necessarily excluded. Of course, there might be a cosmological constant. I don't really want to talk about that now, but I'd better put it in here for completeness. There might be a cosmological constant, and this is CDM. For the cosmological constant, the density could be 7/10. This is another talk, which you may well hear about another time. This isn't very relevant for my story. Whether you exclude zero is based on essentially one data set, which is the supernovae. So if the supernovae data set turned out to have some unexpected problem that we didn't know about, then the other arguments, I think, are relatively weak. So then, you know, maybe we should go back to zero and figure out something else. There is an observational argument that the sum of these two, plus the baryons, which I'm going to get to next, ought to be close to one. And that's from the observation of the shape of the fluctuation spectrum in the microwave background. So if this turned out to be zero, then the current microwave background observations are forcing us to take a larger value here. In which? Yes, there is some theory there. It basically it's a direct measure of the geometry of the universe. And I think this will be much clearer in after the next round of experiments, which are currently underway, are completed, because they will actually measure the power spectrum microwave background in the relevant range much better than the current values. And then, if they continue to agree with the standard model, it will get very difficult to think of alternatives. Although, probably not impossible. There's a low baryonic content in this standard paradigm. And this comes from arguments from nucleosynthesis, which say that the fraction of the critical density in baryons times the Hubble constant in units of 100 squared is of order 2%. And that comes from the abundance of deuterium in quasi-absorption lines. So it seems that the baryon density is relatively low, and it's this value which we seem to have detected in the quasi-absorption lines at high redshift, or close to it. And the final part of the paradigm, well, the more theoretical ones, is that structure formation is driven by gravity. So gravity is the principal process which converts the relatively small fluctuations at early times into the nonlinear structures we see today. Well, at late times, you can imagine non-gravitational processes associated with hydrodynamical processes, stellar processes, and so on. Yeah. You could also, if you want to have late-time phase transitions in some other kind of cosmological field, certain kinds of defects also, then those can drive structure formation. That's sort of partly gravity, partly not, depending on how you want to think about it. Yes. No. Unless, in defect theories, they could be. Superconducting strings is another version where, you know, they can give out a lot of electromagnetic energy, which could also drive structure at all times. Yeah, that's not consistent with the microwave background fluctuations in the present level of structure. Not to say that things don't become turbulent at late times, they almost certainly do, but they were probably not turbulent at early times. It's generally accepted, yeah. That's to say, there's still very few. There are lots of ways to destroy deuterium because it's actually very weakly bound. There are very few ways being suggested to produce it, although there have been some. But the fact that you seem to see consistent deuterium abundances in quasi-absorption line clouds along different lines of sight suggests that it's actually some global process rather than a local one. No, even from Hawaii, if you ask them quietly, they now agree with the other value over here. Final point is, how do the galaxies form? Well, the galaxies form as a result of other physical processes taking over once you get nonlinear structures. So that's effectively through dissipative condensation of gas, the baryonic component, inside nonlinear dark matter objects, which are usually called halos. So the idea is, as long as everything is relatively uniform, then the dark matter dominates the growth of structure. The gas components move with the dark matter. Once something collapses, it rattles around until it comes to a kind of gravitational equilibrium. Then you end up with a lump of dark matter with some structure, a gaseous atmosphere of the other material inside it. Then the gaseous material can then radiate its binding energy. And as it does that, then it will fall gravitationally to the center of the dark object, and that's when all the other processes take over. So you can think of this sort of potential well of dark matter like this. The gas in here initially fills this, and because of radiative processes, it loses its pressure support and has to flow inwards. Eventually, it forms a puddle at the center, which becomes self-gravitating. Then other processes have to take over, form the stars, and so on. And then you end up with a galaxy sitting at the center of this dark matter distribution, which is then a halo around it, which is the origin of this name. Okay, so what are the consequences? So that's basically the current standard model, and there are lots of almost every part of it, somebody will have at least investigated an alternative. So, on the other hand, still true that most work in the field is currently still within this paradigm. So then what are its consequences of this paradigm for galaxy formation? That's the subject of our workshop, is essentially understanding this last part in this overall context. So the first thing that you find, which is actually, it's probably sound obvious to somebody from outside the field, but it's actually a substantial shift in mentality for people in the field, is that you have to think of galaxy formation as a process, not an event. And the traditional way to think about modeling galaxies was to say, well, we'll assume a galaxy formed, it collapsed at redshift 5, and then it just evolved after that. So, you know, there was a time, and a particular event you could actually label as the formation of the galaxy. When you follow through... I need to back up. I missed off one very important point over here, which is the actual nature of the fluctuations. So I'm going to back up. Get my notes here. There's one more element of the standard paradigm, which is critical for what I'm going to say next. And that is that the initial structure all the things over here just tell you about the homogeneous universe. Obviously, you want to know about the formation of structure. We have to actually specify the deviations from uniformity, because those are actually what gives rise to everything we see. And so the question is, what sets the initial conditions, the initial deviations from uniformity? And the dominant paradigm at the moment, although not the only possibility, assumes that this comes from zero-point fluctuations during an inflationary epoch. So this imagines that in the very early universe, there was a phase transition which led the energy density of the universe to be dominated by some field, which is out of equilibrium, which was driving which you can think of kind of like the latent heat of a supercooled steam. That drives the expansion. During this period, you can ask, what are the consequences of zero-point fluctuations in this, whatever this quantum field is? And under certain circumstances, you can actually find that they can be responsible for all the structure in the present universe. And so that's the paradigm that's been most studied, and the reason it's been most studied is it makes relatively simple predictions, and so therefore you can investigate the consequences relatively easily. Correct. So I was just going to list them. So the initial conditions are then a Gaussian random field, which is the simplest possible random field. It's specified only by its power spectrum. Secondly, most plausibly, that it's adiabatic, What that means in this context is that all the components of the universe are perturbed in the same way, because they were all generated by the at the end of the phase transition from the fluctuations in this inflaton field. And near scale invariant. Inflationary expansion here is an exponential process, and it's also almost time invariant during inflation, so that different times during inflation process correspond to very different scales in the universe today. As a result, anything which comes from fluctuations in the inflaton field should be in some sense almost the same on all scales today. And the sense in which they're almost the same is that the fluctuation in the Newtonian gravitational potential, units if you like, the speed of the light, is roughly constant on all scales, and it has to be about 10 to the minus 5 in order to be consistent with what you see in the microwave background radiation. So this is the final element, and there are a lot of details I glossed over in exactly how you do this, but this is the general kind of properties that are taken. And so I left that out. The reason that's important is that in asking how the galaxies form, which is equivalent to asking how things collapse on different mass scales and at different times, the critical element there is this Gaussian, because that specified the statistical nature of the initial conditions. Now, in turbulence, taking Gauss initial conditions is kind of like assuming your turbulence is Kolmogorov. You know, once you've done that, everything is easy. Well, easier. Similarly, if you assume things are Gaussian, then you have to give then the initial conditions. You only have to give one function, which is the power per octave in spatial scale, and that specified all the statistical properties of the initial conditions. So then, all you have to do is figure out a way to integrate forwards and ask what happens. So starting from those initial conditions, what you find is that objects of a given scale form over a wide range of epochs. Sorry. What it takes? What you actually do is you, you think you know the initial conditions the time when the universe is approximately linear. So let's call that recombination. Because there we have a direct test, we can compare it with the microwave background fluctuations. So we think we know the initial conditions there, and in this paradigm, we know everything about the initial conditions. So then, in a sense, it's just low energy physics to propagate forwards. So you just need to integrate all your equations of motion for all the components from the time when the universe was 300,000 years old, which is what we see, we think, in the microwave background fluctuations, until the present day. And if you could follow all the nonlinear physics, then you should just integrate forwards and get the present population of galaxies. The problem, of course, is just at least as complicated as predicting the weather from absolute physics. You're not going to do that because there are so many different physical processes interacting on so many scales that you had to make progress in practice, you have to include additional empirical constraints on how things work. So you can think about it as just taking a big numerical simulation, setting up these initial conditions, and just integrating on your computer until you get the outcome. Well, the simplest thing is just to follow the dark matter. Since that's dominant, it only interacts through gravity. So there you have a hope of following almost all the physics that's relevant. To the extent that the baryons are a small perturbation, except at the center of galaxies, you can follow what happens to the dark matter considering only gravitational physics. So that's relatively straightforward. You then have a closed system of equations that you understand. It's the collisionless Boltzmann equation for the distribution of the dark matter and Poisson's equation for the gravitational field. So you just have to find some way to integrate that forwards. When you want to look at the baryonic physics, then while it's relatively diffuse, it's still fairly easy. You just have a compressible fluid with initially small inhomogeneities which grow in time, driven by the forcing field of the dark matter, and which is dissipative because it has radiation. As soon as things actually begin to condense out in this stage, so you get the puddles of baryons forming at the center of dark matter halos, then a lot of other physics becomes important. The formation of the stars, the multiphase nature of the gas, magnetic fields, cosmic rays, many things. So at that point, you become almost purely phenomenological in practice. You can't integrate it forwards directly at all. That's correct, yes. No, they are, in fact. That's an interesting point, and you're probably from the turbulence field, because in turbulence that's the case. And so you can ask, why are the initial conditions still important in galaxies? and not in turbulence, or put a different way, on which scales are the initial conditions still important in turbulence and in galaxies, whereas you would think not in turbulence. And the reason comes, in turbulence, one of the natural assumptions you make is that the life of your system, or its age at the time you look at it, is many turnover times of the scales you're looking at. And that's not the case. When we look at galaxies, that's probably my next point here, is that structures are still forming today. And so the structures that form today are still on their first turnover time. Yeah. And so you actually have it's actually quite an interesting question from a turbulence point of view. You, by looking at different scales, you see a transition from what's effectively just amplified linear noise. So you see some non-Gaussianity, which is produced by the nonlinear amplification, but it's still essentially seeing the initial conditions. On small scales, we have had many dynamical times. Then to some extent, you've forgotten your initial conditions, but it's an interesting question to exactly which extent you've forgotten. Second point here is that galaxy formation continues to redshift zero. Which is just the point that structures are still forming and collapsing today, things inside the galaxy clusters. And this is just the present-day analog of the things that we thought made the galaxies. And galaxies are still interacting with each other today, which is, we think, a present-day version of what happened at higher redshift. As a result of continued collapse of structures, galaxy transformation is continuing. So it's not that you form an elliptical galaxy and then it's an elliptical galaxy forever, or that you form a spiral galaxy and the spiral galaxy forever. If you look at a given object at different times, sometimes it might look like a spiral galaxy, sometimes like an elliptical galaxy, sometimes like something else. And that's because in this Gaussian initial conditions, you find interactions between different objects continually happening. And we can actually see this in the local universe in the form of colliding and interacting galaxies. So it means that interactions and mergers between objects are critical. A consequence of the scale invariance here is that you predict, on the whole, that small things form first. That actually has to be qualified. If you take the details of this particular predicted spectrum here for cold dark matter and look at simulations, you find, although in general it's true that small things form first and aggregate, at any given time you predict a very wide range of masses of objects to be present. So a consequence of that is that if you focus on objects of a given mass today, for example, you could find that they were assembled at a wide range of redshifts.
This statement that galaxy transformation is that a relatively new kind of, is that what the shift?
Well, it depends. Now, I mean, the idea of galaxies merging and this being one formation path for elliptical. Well, the way a spiral becomes an elliptical, and this is it runs into another spiral. Yeah, so the idea, that's a relatively old idea, goes back to the early 70s. The question which is always, is how important is this for the population as a whole? And this theoretical paradigm predicts it should be very important, but also direct observations of the number of interacting galaxies seem to show a substantial increase as you go into the past. So also from an observational point of view, the importance has become is more evident. We only tested the system one way. Okay, well, break in again if you figure out how to make contact. Uh, There's a final point here on this list of consequences, which I wanted to put in, which is that if you look at if you compare high and low redshifts, redshift objects, because obviously the process is a process of transformation from gas to stars, you find that high is the objects that are predicted to be gas rich, relatively, while low is the objects that are expected to be gas poor. And so they predict a difference between present day and distant galaxies. If you look at high redshift, you expect them to have a lot more gas relative to the stars than the galaxies today. Okay, David, what should I do about timing here? How much? If we go for another 15 minutes, is that too long or is that okay? Yeah. I can cut. Let me skip then. What I wanted to finish up with was a list of what I see as the major issues, general issues in the field. Okay, so let me go through those. What I skipped was 5 minutes telling you basically how the different types of galaxies are imagined to form in this picture. But let's skip that because I think the major outstanding issues are probably the more interesting. So the first issue, sort of the obvious one, is can these processes actually produce what we see? Fairly trivial. So we can talk about the luminosity of galaxies, sizes, characteristic velocities. The mix of different types, bulges or spheroidal systems compared to disks. Those are the two major components of galaxies. As you saw in the picture, it was in the middle of the board when we started. You can divide the components of galaxies into thin centrifugally supported disks, like the actual Milky Way we see around the sky in our own galaxy, and more or less spheroidal populations, which are purely stellar, like the central bulge of our Milky Way or like an elliptical galaxy. And so different galaxies at the grossest level are characterized by the total amount of stars they contain and the fraction of the stars in these two components, the disk component and the bulge component. And then these are the measures of the characteristic properties, the characteristic potential well depth, characteristic linear size. Then, of course, we have to understand the evolution. So this is a fairly... I mean, look, we think we know the initial conditions. We have a model. We have to integrate forward and see if we produce the observed universe. On this level, there's already one clear problem which has emerged. And that comes in predicting disk sizes. This is a major issue at the moment. If you take this picture, you ask what sets the size of the linear size of the disk of our Milky Way. In effect, it's total angular momentum, because it's centrifugally supported, so it settles down at the size which is appropriate for its angular momentum. So asking what sets its size is equivalent to asking what sets its angular momentum. In this picture, the angular momentum is a gravitational consequence of the nonlinear growth, and we think we can calculate it. What you find is if the angular momentum given to the gas by the nonlinear growth is conserved until it makes a disk, then we can predict the sizes and they come out right. The problem arises when you try to do a numerical simulation of this process. You find the gas acquires the angular momentum during the initial phases, but then as it settles to make the disk, it loses it again. And it loses it by nonlinear processes transferring angular momentum from the gas back to the dark matter. The result of these loss mechanisms is you end up with disks which are substantially smaller than the observed ones. And there's not understood at the moment what the resolution of this problem is going to be. So you have to find out a way that as the gas settles to make a disk, it retains the angular momentum it was originally given gravitationally and doesn't lose it again. Yeah, it's a nonlinear gravitational processes during the collapse. That's what. Well, factor of 3 or 5 anyway. I'm not sure it's as much as an order of magnitude. The problem is the angular momentum loss during collapse is too high in simulations. Now, it's unclear whether this is a real problem with the overall framework or this just means that the physics is not yet included in the simulations, is changing their behavior. So obviously the people working in the field hope that when they have more realistic physics for how the gas interacts with the rest of the rest of the system as it's collapsing, then this may alter the collapse process and reduce this angular momentum loss. But it's, no one's yet demonstrated this is actually feasible. No, I'll come to that in a minute. In fact, that's next. So the next question is, do nonlinear, do processes give the correct nonlinear structure for objects? Now, for the galaxies themselves, this is a very complicated question because that depends on all the nonlinear physics of the gas condensation, the star formation, supernova explosion, and so on. But you can at least ask for the dark matter objects, the dark matter halos, which have only grown through gravity, whether the model is predicting the correct structure for those. And you can ask on different scales. You can ask whether it produces the right structure for galaxy clusters. The galaxy cluster is a single object with many galaxies inside it. So you can ask, does this produce a dark matter, a large dark matter lump with smaller lumps inside it, which could be identified with the individual galaxies? And the answer appears to be yes. The level that's been investigated so far, there isn't doesn't appear to be a problem here.
When you say that theory and observation fail by yes here, what does that mean?
Well, effectively, you make a simulation of the formation of an object with a mass predicted for rich cluster. You do it with sufficiently high resolution that you could see, in principle, see objects that could be identified with individual galaxies inside it, still in the dark matter distribution, of course. And then you count them and ask, are there enough with the right masses to be consistent with the galaxies? And you find there are.
And when you say that when it's right like this, it would be 10%?
No, unfortunately, it's much closer to 50 than 10. And that's because to actually make the comparison, what you really observe for the galaxies is their luminosity. So to convert from what you see in a dark matter simulation to the luminosities, you need additional modeling.
Okay, so we understand that you see 1.5 is okay, 3 is not okay.
It depends on the problem. It depends on the problem. As in any field, right? You have to assess what you need is for the difference to be larger than what you think your systematic errors are or uncertainties. So it depends which aspect of the field you look at. You can ask on galaxy halos. So you can ask whether the structure predicted for the dark matter distribution around the Milky Way is consistent with observation. I'll come to that in a minute. And then you can ask whether the central distribution of the dark matter in objects is consistent with observation, which I'll call cause of dark halos. And there appears to be there are two problems here. One, I think, which is really is a clear problem. That is, if you have a lump of dark matter that's roughly in equilibrium, it's not spherical, but it's not very far off, you can ask, what would happen if I put a disk of material in centrifugal balance inside this potential well? And just centrifugal balance then allows you to predict how fast this disk should be rotating as a function of distance from the center. And you get something which looks like this. The dark matter distributions are predicted to be quite cuspy, to have a density which continues to increase all the way to their center. And so that produces a rotation curve, looks like this. You know, put axes in. You look at observations of such rotation curves in dwarf galaxies, you try to match them, and typically you get something which looks like this. Which suggests that the velocity in the real galaxy is rising more slowly than is predicted for the dark matter in the model. Which seems to suggest there's less dark matter near the center of the galaxy than is predicted by the theory. Or in other words, the dark matter halos are less concentrated than is predicted by the theory. Now, there are a lot of questions associated with this, but it does appear that there's a clear discrepancy, so that's a major uncertainty. If this was substantiated, then it becomes very difficult, because this only depends on the gravitational evolution from the initial condition. So if you could substantiate this and show it was not possibly due to the nonlinear processes associated with the formation of the galaxy itself, then you would exclude the whole class of models. So that's why this particular issue is one that gets a lot of attention. And this is the one that motivated the suggestion that dark matter might have a significant self-interaction. Although my current belief is that actually makes the problem worse, not better. Right, so warm dark matter is an intermediate possibility. warm dark matter is an intermediate possibility, which people have suggested, but it gives the wrong kind of scaling for the structures of the centered objects, so it doesn't look terribly promising to me. There's a possible problem here, which I don't think is yet really demonstrated to be a problem, so in the interest of time, let me say that I don't currently think there's a demonstrated problem that the structure predicted for the halo of the Milky Way is different from that observed, or is inconsistent with observations of the Milky Way. There are two more problems, and then I'm done. One is related to a question that we had earlier. And that question is, where are all the baryons today? So we claimed to be able to see all the baryons predicted by nucleosynthesis at redshift 3. It's not that far in the past. Where are they today? The amount we've been able to see directly today is about an order of magnitude smaller. So we haven't yet directly observationally identified where those baryons went. And so until we do, then I think there's a clear major uncertainty in the whole problem. There are several possibilities. It could be, which is in the standard paradigm, the most plausible one, is it's still just diffuse into galactic gas. It's easy to show that if the material is diffuse, lies between the galaxies, and has a temperature of a fraction of a million degrees, that it would be almost impossible to observe it. So, absence of evidence. Something. There are theoretical questions associated with that. Could it actually, some of it, condense into dense objects? There is a claim, after all, in our galactic halo, there's a substantial population of objects of mass to half a solar mass of type unknown, which is seen as gravitational lenses. Maybe. I mean, I don't want to say one way or another. We heard from David Spergel about a week ago about high-velocity clouds, which are relatively low-density but fairly massive clouds of neutral hydrogen gas flying around. Could some fraction of it be in these objects? Could they be represented part of the medium? I think it's unlikely this is all of it. So we need to find it. There's a clear problem here with the paradigm. But if most of the gas is still diffuse, you should at least be able to see it in nonlinear objects. We do see it in galaxy clusters. Most of the gas in galaxy clusters is a hot X-ray emitting gas between the galaxies. You would also predict around spiral galaxies that their halos should also be filled with hot gas. And the current limits from X-ray observations seem inconsistent with what's expected. So there's a clear problem here. There's a lack of X-ray halos around spirals, and particularly around the most massive spirals. The predicted luminosities are almost a factor of 100 above the limits for simple models. So the simple models have to be wrong, or something else is going on we don't understand. This, I think, is a major problem that hasn't actually got much attention yet, but I think is important. Not usually, but as you know, the main way that we're supposed to get around this problem is by keeping the gas hot so that it can condense more slowly. If you do that, then you should be able to see it, and we don't. It has to be at the virial temperature of the halo. So if you look at something, you look at like a big galaxy like the Sombrero with a circular velocity of 300 kilometers a second, it has to be at a million degrees. And the limits on the X-ray halo of the Sombrero are quite tight. Yeah, but, you know, I'm just pointing out there is a problem, and it's fairly large, so we need to figure out what's going on. But then, no, but the problem is then you have a different problem. Mm-hmm. Let me just put up the final problem, because this is just the final problem, which I think is, can galaxy formation be used to check the paradigm? For example, could we actually derive some of the parameters in the cosmological model by studying galaxy formation? And there I think it's currently very unclear. I think the nonlinear physics involved in the galaxy formation is sufficiently poorly understood and sufficiently important in the whole process that I don't have much confidence that we'll actually ever be able to use the galaxy formation process to set cosmological parameters. But obviously, you would like to show that at least you can get a plausible population of galaxies in whatever you think is the correct model of the universe. What lambda, if you compare a lambda-dominated universe to a matter-dominated flat universe, what happens is that the galaxy formation shifts significantly back in time. So in a high-density universe, you would predict galaxy formation to be significantly more recent. So in principle, this could be detectable. I think, one part which you do have a fair amount of tests on is the Gaussian question. But there again, you'll get a much cleaner test from the microwave background fluctuation. So I don't think this would be the route of choice to look at this. Okay.